AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. A New York jury finds FTX founder Sam Bankman-Fried guilty on all counts for defrauding his cryptocurrency customers and investors out of at least $10 billion. U.S. Attorney Damian Williams.
It's a warning, this case, to every single fraudster out there who thinks that they're untouchable.
Williams says Bankman-Fried and his partners engaged in one of the biggest frauds in U.S. history. More from CBS News legal analyst Thane Rosenbaum.
Bankman-Fried took a calculated risk by testifying on his own behalf. He did so largely to discredit his former girlfriend and two of his best friends, all allies and shareholders in FTX, who took plea deals with federal prosecutors and testified that Bankman-Fried was the mastermind behind the fraud that wiped out his investors. Their testimonies all matched up. Bankman-Fried apparently was unconvincing.
Bankman-Fried has been convicted of wire fraud, conspiracy to commit fraud, and money laundering. The U.S. House takes up a more than $14 billion military aid package for Israel.
The bill is passed.
But CBS's Scott McFarland reports.
Here at the Capitol, this is a first step to getting aid to Israel. $14 billion plus approved by the U.S. House, but this bill is dead on arrival in the Senate. Democrats in the Senate don't like the provision that would require cuts to the IRS to pay for the Israeli aid, arguing the IRS cuts would actually inflame the deficit.
As Israel's military says, its troops have encircled Gaza City in heavy fighting with Hamas militants. It continues its shelling of the territory. For a second straight day, hundreds of people with foreign passports have been allowed to cross from the Gaza Strip into Egypt. In a late-night court filing, former President Donald Trump's attorneys are asking the D.C. Court of Appeals to stay Judge Tanya Chutkan's gag order over the D.C. election-related special counsel case. The finding alleges it's muzzling the former president on the campaign trail. Earlier today, in former president's New York civil fraud trial, Donald Trump Jr. wrapped up his testimony, later saying,
"If we were actually dealing with logic and reason the way business is conducted, but unfortunately the Attorney General has brought forth a case that is purely a political persecution."
Eric Trump has testified that he was never involved with the family business's financial statements. Their sister Ivanka has lost her appeal and will testify next Wednesday. U.S. applications for jobless benefits inched higher, and Cedar Fair and Six Flags will merge to create a playtime powerhouse in North America. On Wall Street, the Dow closed up 565 points. This is CBS News.
You don't need a job platform, you need a hiring partner. Indeed lets you schedule and conduct virtual interviews all from one place. Start at Indeed.com/credits.
Be a part of the resistance. Check out The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson, Monday nights at 7 on The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM WAUK, and on the Civic Media app.
Race-based consideration in higher education programs take another step. The Assembly Colleges and Universities Committee took up a bill Thursday. Among other things, it would guarantee admission to Wisconsin State Universities and technical colleges for high school students who graduate in the top 5% of their class. It would also take race out of the equation for financial aid decisions. Governor Evers admits he hasn't visited any state prisons recently, even though three inmates have died in 4 months. People in prisons in Waupun, Green Bay, and Stanley have had to stay in their cells around the clock since March due to staffing shortages. Families say they're concerned about their mental and physical health. Evers says his corrections secretary visits the Waupun prison every day. Democrats introduced a slate of bills looking to improve prison conditions on Thursday. I'm Nate Wiggehout, Civic Media News.
The Bucks get crushed by the Raptors. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks losing to the Raptors in Toronto, 130-111. Toronto shot 56% from the field, hit 15 three-point shots, and were 13 out of 14 from the foul line. What happened defensively to the Bucks? Head coach Adrian Griffin.
Defensively,
I didn't think we did a good job as far as keeping the ball in front. You know, too many points in the paint as far as kick out threes.
The Bucks return to Milwaukee to host the New York Knicks Friday night. Tip-off time, 6:30. NFL, the Packers host the Rams Sunday, but L.A.'s quarterback Matthew Stafford, struggling with a thumb injury, Brett Rippon, could start at quarterback. Now, he's the nephew of quarterback Mark Rippon, who led Washington to a Super Bowl win in 1991. The Packers trying to break a four-game slump, wide receiver Christian Watson.
I just want to find a way to win. You know, I've never been okay with losing. I want to compete. I want to win. You just got to find a way to do it.
That's the Packers' Christian Watson. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. Mainly cloudy tonight with a low of 36. Southwest winds 8 to 15 miles an hour. 49 tomorrow, chance for scattered showers. Lows around 35 tomorrow night. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Derek Height. Currently, it's 43 degrees.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us. Your home of the Earl Ingram Show. Weekday mornings from 8 till 10 on The Shaw. 540 AM and 101.1 FM WAUK.
Investing nearly $20 billion to help farmers and ranchers tackle climate crisis through climate-smart agriculture and cover crops. Nutrient management. Reducing greenhouse gas emissions while improving overall health of the soil and the water.
Did you hear that, farmers and ranchers? Did you hear who's actually helping you out? For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter at Green News Report.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Outside of Sherrod Brown, Sheldon Whitehouse, one of my favorite senators, by far. Today, he tweeted out, there is no justification for a CEO making hundreds of times what the average workers earn at their company. That's why he, Barbara Lee, AOC, just introduced a bill to apply an excise tax on companies with at least a 50-to-1 CEO to median worker pay disparity. And you go, about time? Been screaming this for this for a while. But again, this is another one of those reasons why I love Sheldon Whitehouse. But I said, you know, look, you know, what about the ones that are 500, 1,000-to-1? What should we do to them? A small excise tax isn't going to deter them. Maybe something a little more draconian. Maybe, you know, I don't know. Maybe something worse than a little tax. But here to share some thoughts on, well, this idea and maybe where we take it from here, I've asked our good friend Bob Lord to come talk with us. Bob's a senior advisor on tax policy with the Patriotic Millionaires. He's also an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
You bet. Happy to be here.
So what do you make of this? Is 51, is that enough? Should it be more? What should we do? Tell me.
Well, I guess there's two answers to that. One is, you know, like maybe something publicly, you know, to this CEO if it's 500-to-1, but that's not realistic. It would, as you and I talked before, it'd be a great deterrent.
You know, you just eat one of them. That's all. You know, right. I have a friend who came out and said, we need to eat the rich. And he said, you'd only have to eat the first one and the rest would fall in line. And
exactly.
I said, that's great, but I'm a very picky eater.
But, I mean, I haven't seen the legislation in detail. I haven't had a chance to look at it. But does the excise tax increase as that ratio increases? Because that's the way it should work.
That's the way it should work, right.
they, you know, if they go just a hair over the 50, they should get like a little smack. But if they get to, you know, 200, 300, 400, 500 to 1, there should be a whopper of an excise tax.
No, I agree. And this again, you know, we just went through a contract fight with the UAW, and you look at the wealth that our CEOs at the big three were pocketing, and it's obscene. The account, what was it, $1 billion over the last 10 years the three of them pocketed.
Oh, I mean, they make more money their first day of work in January than regular workers do the whole year. It's obscene.
And for me, this is why I keep going back to, we need to dig up the policies of the good socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower, and bring those back. That's how we bring this country back to somewhere near the sane line. We get rid of all of these billionaires. There should not be a billionaire in this country.
There absolutely should not be a billionaire. The wealth over $1 billion should be taxed in a confiscatory manner.
Yeah, where do you go with that? So how do you get to the place where we do away with that? Because look, in this day and age, we're not going back to a 92% tax rate, although I think we should. We can't even get a tax put on billionaires to help fund the tax credit for kids to keep them to be able to eat the earned income tax credit. We couldn't even fund that, and we allowed childhood poverty to double because, hey, we got to keep those tax breaks in place, Bob.
We had that child tax credit and earned income tax credit together had cut poverty by over 50%, and you're right, they took it away at the end of 2021, and those poverty rates for kids doubled.
I mean, it's just absolutely crazy where we are. And the thing is, you've got these rich people, and we were sold this idea that we would cut taxes and we would give, the smart people the money because they knew what to do with it. And somehow that was going to benefit us working schlubs because it would trickle down. This is what we were sold. And you know this as well as anyone. We were told, give them the money. They know what to do with it. And they do. They do know what to do with it. They make more money for themselves, not for anyone else. And thank goodness for divorce. I'm going to champion divorce in this moment because there was a story over at Forbes magazine. Because we find out a lot of these excesses. We find out a lot of these abuses because of divorce lawyers who, they want to get a little bit for their client. I look at this billionaire, this John Overdeck, who evidently had a trust that they set up in New Jersey because they didn't want to pay taxes. They wanted to dodge that. And then somehow, in the mid, 2013, I think it was, they decided to move it from New Jersey to Wyoming. But somehow in that move, in there was inserted a little clause that if for any reason there was a divorce, the wife would get cut out and would get basically nothing, which is funny in a way, because not only has he screwed the taxpayers, well, he's no longer screwing his wife. So there's this. Am I missing something here?
No, look, these trusts, and Wyoming's one of the leaders. The big one is South Dakota, and Alaska, Nevada, and I think Delaware also play in this game, and more states are jumping into it. And so these trusts have three purposes for these super rich folks. One is they avoid tax, particularly estate and gift tax. Second is they can screw their spouses. The third is they can screw anyone who they happen to have legal liability to. So you have these cases. There's one with the DuPont family. I think there was another one with the S.C. Johnson family where they do awful things. Like they drive drunk and hurt somebody and they get sued. And the person suing them wins the case and gets a judgment for, a gazillion dollars, but then they can't collect on it because the money in that trust, the wealth in that trust can't be reached. So they're protected from tax, they're protected from divorce, and protected from legal liability.
Wow. I mean, because I look at this case and, evidently, she knew him when they were just starting out, and I guess he had just started his hedge fund, just before they got married, and, throughout their marriage.
They were married for 20 years, Rick. They were married for 20 years.
Right. And somehow over the course of their marriage, he accumulated somewhere in the range of $7.3 billion. And you would think, you know, in the era of halves, you'd get half of that. Evidently not getting much, because most of this stuff is tied up in this trust that she's now claiming that the lawyers didn't advise her, and the lawyers, I guess, you know, gave her the shaft. It'll be an interesting case to see how this plays out. But for me, it's amazing that, you know, someone who's got $7.5 billion, not only cheating the taxpayers, but yeah, cheating the wife.
Well, look, Rick, come on. You know, you can obviously live much, much better on $7 billion than you could on $3.5 billion,
can't
right?
You?
I mean, there's so much more stuff you could buy with $7 billion that you could never ever buy with $3.5 billion. These people, they're mentally ill. They really are mentally ill.
And but, you know, it comes back to the, you know, these lawsuits for me, you know, do expose the excesses of our billionaire class. And again, if you're an average everyday working stiff who's struggling to put gas in the car and put food on the table, you got to be looking at this and going, you know, how is this allowed to exist? How is it that, you know, I've got to pay tax on every dime that I earn? I've got to, you know, I've got to pay my bills. But you got these people who have unimaginable wealth, who have gamed a system that they've rigged that benefits them and screws the rest of us. I'm just, you know, this is where I think people should really be angry about. I don't care about who marries who. I don't care if you wear a dress or Birkenstocks. I don't care any of that. This is what we should be angry about.
Absolutely. And it just doesn't get out there. And, you know, look, the media is obviously doing a really crummy job of getting that stuff out there.
Yeah, and that's why you guys are here. That's why the patriotic millionaires are here, to expose all of these scams and schemes. And so the question is, how do we fix this? Because I don't think most people realize that, you know, South Dakota is the, you know, is the safe haven for billionaires, or Delaware or Nevada or Wyoming. How do we change this?
By the way, not just U.S. billionaires. A lot of, you know, European billionaires that can't squirrel things away under their own country's laws use South Dakota trusts. Look, we change it by strengthening our tax system, so people can't accumulate this much wealth, and the ones that do will have it taxed away from them over a relatively short period of time. That's what has to be done.
So when Republicans pass a bill to give aid to Israel, and as a part of giving aid to Israel, we slash funding to the IRS, who exactly does that help?
Well, it helps the billionaires, because the funding to the IRS was going to be used to go after billionaires and multimillionaires, and it would have actually brought in, I think it's like $12 of tax revenue for every dollar that was spent. So it makes absolutely no sense. They're going to reduce spending on the IRS, which makes money, in order to cover the cost of the aid to Israel. I mean, why not just leave that aid alone?
Right.
Leave that funding to the IRS alone, and it'll pay for the aid to Israel.
Well, but what it is it's the ideology, though, Bob.
Absolutely.
You know, it's this, you know, we have, as a society, have been trained to, you know, whenever we hear IRS, we foam at the mouth like Pavlovian dogs, because they've trained us to think this way. And the billionaires, they know, you know, look, we're going to tax the little guy. We know that. You know, I think George Carlin said it the best. You know, I miss George Carlin every day. He said it the best, where, you know, the middle class does all the work, pays all the taxes. The rich take all the money, does none of the work, and the poor are there to keep the middle class showing up to those jobs, feeding the rich and taking care of them. And I don't think there's a more complete sentence than that.
That's a pretty good summation of it. Yeah, I agree.
So I keep coming back
to this. I mean, this Israel aid thing, it's a twofer for them. They get the aid to Israel, and they protect the billionaires.
Why don't we know more about this, though? I mean, this is the thing that gets me. It's been about 15 years since I've learned about these tax havens. And, you know, not just here, but all across the world. I mean, you look at the Caymans. You know, everyone knows about Switzerland, but even they've got some rules. Why isn't this more of an issue, do you think?
Well, look, you know, our laws are just built to protect these guys. Look at what happened with all that ProPublica reporting, where whoever leaked the information to the IRS is going to wind up spending a fair chunk of time in prison. But the tax cheating that he exposed, that'll go unpunished.
I got to tell you, we've got all the wrong priorities in this moment. But Bob, as always, I appreciate the time, the insight. Good stuff.
Thanks, Rick. Good to be here.
Our good friend Bob Lord. Make sure you check out their website. PatrioticMillionaires.org is the site. Bob is their senior tax advisor on tax policy. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You know, I got to tell you, I love these lawsuits. We wouldn't have found out anything about Jack Welch and GE and just the obscene retirement package that he got. You know, Hacksaw Jack, the guy who was, dumped thousands of workers and destroyed their pension, destroyed thousands of lives, and yet, had access to your homes in virtually every city across the country, had, fresh flowers daily in all of the houses in case he showed up, tickets to every sporting event and every event he could possibly want to go to, access to their jet whenever he wanted, just obscene kind of things that were in his retirement package. And the only reason we found out is, well, Mrs. Welch took him to court and sued for half of that. Because she had gotten accustomed to the lifestyle. There you go. Let's go to the phones. Got Alice on line one. Alice, how are you?
Semi-coherent.
All right. What's got you?
So what I wanted to say was, you were talking earlier about you and Sarah, about the shenanigans going on with Santos and all that. So, of course, I was lucky enough, sarcasm heavily there, to speak with the local Trump supporter today. Lucky me. And
why do you do that to yourself?
I was minding my own business, raking the yard. And,
I find that hard
up.
To believe.
I was, believe me. I go out of my way to avoid this person. My cats see her coming and they run. My feral cat colony, they run. But anyways, so she comes over and she starts talking to me, and I'm trying, and I try to avoid these subjects. And of course she said, well, you should be happy with the Democratic Party. And I'm like, well, yeah, I am. And she said, well, I'll give you this much. The Democrats sure stick together. And I'm like, okay. And she proceeded to inform me that, of course, it is the Democrats' fault that we didn't have a speaker, And I said, how is that like the Democrats' fault? Because the Republicans have the majority, and Matt Gaetz is the one and that brought it up to get rid of him.
Yeah.
And he's a Republican the last time I checked. She said, well, the Democrats got together with him to get rid of him. They all, you've seen what they done, why it took so long. That was all the Democrats' fault.
Wow.
And I looked at her and I said, have you lost your ever-loving mind?
I wish Democrats had the kind of power that woman thinks they have.
I know. And then she proceeded to tell me that, of course, you know, it's all, they're out to get poor Santos. And I just looked at her and I said, you know what? I'm done discussing with you politics. I said, you know, we've talked about this before. We don't talk politics and we don't talk religion. And she said, well, then I guess I don't need to talk to you anymore. And I said, see ya. Oh, my God.
Don't do me any favors.
They've all lost their, mind. But have a good evening, Rick.
Thanks, Alice. Appreciate it. Yeah, I know a couple of those as well. And look, you know, I enjoy the conversation. I actually do. There is some humor in their insanity. There's an opportunity to hear a different point of view. And as long as you don't think you're going to change them, and I know they're fives, you can't. They do provide some bit of entertainment. But you know, here's the thing, and I want to go back to this story with this billionaire. You know, here's a guy, you know, worth almost $7.5 billion. And, you know, figuring out a way not just to cheat the taxpayers, not just to cheat, you know, society as a whole, but his entire family. And I find it really, really interesting on how, you know, the moneyed interests always figure out how to protect themselves. Now, this woman is obviously suing the law firm that she says was supposed to be acting in her best interest as well. And I think she might have a case. But, you know, you think about, you know, just how often this kind of stuff happens, that it doesn't get any press, where the, you know, the moneyed interests have figured out how to rig the system in their favor. And how they just, at every opportunity, it's about, you know, I think like, as Bob Lord said, you know, there's so much you can buy with $7 billion that you can't buy with $3 billion. And he was being facetious, but, you know, the reality is that it's never enough. You know, I remember the CEO of Caterpillar was once asked, how much profit is enough? And the guy said, it's never enough. We can never have enough. You know, basically, we want to grab that quarter and squeeze it till the eagle screams. And that, if that means cutting wages down to poverty wages, that means destroying health care and retirement benefits. If it means, you know, poverty wage, desperation class jobs, that's what it means, because it means profit for us. And that's the billionaire mindset. That's the wealth class's mindset. And how dare you think that you should be entitled to their earnings and their hard work? And look, the reality is that they've convinced a lot of working people to think the same way, because, you know, there are a lot of embarrassed millionaires out there. Haven't got that million yet, but they're going to someday. And they don't want to pay taxes. Without realizing that, you know, when that kind of wealth accumulates at the top, the power accumulates with it. And in a more egalitarian society where wealth is distributed more equally, people have more opportunities. You know, someone said earlier, you know, the too big to fail also means too small to succeed. And there's a lot of truth in that. You know, when you have these giant monopolies, you know, who's going to compete against Amazon? You're not going to compete against them. The best you can do is hope to latch on and take advantage of the monopoly that they've built. And now we find that their algorithms are such that even if you do try and compete with them on their platform, they're still taking the advantage over you. And we don't have the legal framework to stop it. Because, again, our system's based on who makes the campaign contributions.
Our system's based on, you know, who gets the ear of our elected officials. And this is where, again, I come back to, you know, the way we take this country back is by reunionizing, by giving working people the power of numbers and an organization to be able to fight for them. I say it all the time. I've got a lobbyist in Congress. I'm a member of the Teamsters Union. We've got a lobbyist fighting for issues that are important to our careers and our livelihoods and our best interests. Most working people don't. And this is one of those moments where, and I know I say this a lot, but in order for us to...
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK.
CBS News Brief. FTX founder Sam Bankman-Fried is convicted of defrauding cryptocurrency customers. A New York federal jury rejected his testimony that he did not defraud customers. U.S. Attorney Damian Williams.
Sam Bankman-Fried perpetrated one of the biggest financial frauds in American history. A multi-billion dollar scheme designed to make him the king of crypto.
The House approves a more than $14 billion military aid package for Israel, but without Gaza humanitarian assistance. It also includes cuts to the IRS and no funding for Ukraine. CBS's Scott McFarlane.
This bill is going nowhere in the Senate, and the White House says the president would veto it.
Donald Trump Jr. wraps up his testimony in the New York civil fraud case against his family and their business.
Before even having a day in court, I'm apparently guilty of fraud for relying on my accountant to do, wait for it, accounting.
Eric Trump has also testified, and Ivanka Trump hits the stand on Wednesday. CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. It's your hometown radio. Refresh.
For Civic Media News, I'm Nate Wagiho. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss is moving forward with impeaching the state's top election administrator. He moved articles of impeachment against Megan Wolf to the Assembly Committee on Government Accountability and Oversight on Thursday. That's after a group launched a six-figure ad buy calling for Voss's removal if he didn't move forward with impeaching Wolf. That ad was filled with incorrect statements about Megan Wolf's involvement in the 2020 presidential election. Governor Evers says he's leaning on Senate Democrats to get an American Family Field maintenance bill passed. Democrats have said they don't like that the bill spends almost $500 million in public money, but asked for much less from the Milwaukee Brewers. The governor says he's persuaded some Democrats to vote for the bill. He says any significant changes to the bill might kill Democratic support. I'm Nate Wagiho, Civic Media News.
Think you'd like working with us at Civic Media? We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin. If you have the right skills to join our team, let's talk. Civic Media is a proud equal opportunity employer committed to diversity and inclusion, along with the growth and development of all current and future employees. If you're interested or are part of an organization who wants to know more, go to our website, civicmedia.us, and click on the Careers tab.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. Mainly cloudy tonight with a low of 36. Southwest winds 8 to 15 miles an hour. 49 tomorrow, chance for scattered showers. Lows around 35 tomorrow night. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Eric Height. Currently, it's 43 degrees.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here. I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
You are listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Thank you. Did you know we are always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app too? And if you miss a show or game, find it wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, civicmedia.us.
Waukesha, home of Les Paul, our awesome farmers market, and The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
But by literally putting its power source in customers' homes, businesses, schools, etc.
Specifically, Green Mountain will install television-sized storage batteries statewide in homes and buildings, each one soaking up wind and solar energy when the weather is right, releasing stored power when needed. This turns out to be far cheaper than building central power plants, having to constantly replace miles of electric lines downed by storms and paying for widespread power outages. Plus, it delivers priceless customer goodwill by doing away with infuriating outages that shut down people's lights, refrigerators, medical equipment, etc. We don't want the power to be off for our customers ever, says McClure. Indeed, power outages cost U.S. utilities about $150 billion a year, while costing customers even more. That's a failed system. Green Mountain Power is turning away from business-as-usual greed, literally generating energy sanity. This is Jim Hightower saying, what's your utility doing?
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So while all the attention has been the UAW's Big Three contract, and look, historic stuff there, and I'm hoping going to move labor into bigger and better circles, and we're going to see more organizing and more contracts, going to make lives better. You know, some things are going on that not getting the headlines like that, and one of those is a recently ratified contract by the Code for America Workers. The Code for America Workers United members, they just overwhelmingly voted to ratify their first collective bargaining agreement. And I don't think you know how big of a deal it is to get that first contract and to make sure that it's a good one. And here to share some thoughts on, well, what they got and what it means, I've asked James Arms, Principal Solutions Architect and Contract Action Team member, to come talk with us, along with Lindley Clawson. She's the Program Manager and the Bargaining Committee member with the OPIU Union. Guys, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks. We're happy to be here.
So this is kind of a big deal. I mean, the fact that you've got you know people, coders, organizing, you've got computer workers, office workers organizing, and then getting that first contract. James, let me ask you this, because you know this is a big action. This is a big to do. How'd you do it?
Well, you know, it wasn't just me. It was our entire unit. And it took a lot of time. It was a lot of people before me, is a lot of people beside me. And it's a lot of people still going strong. We took a lot of strong collective action. We took time to really get to know our members and what was important to them. And, you know, we just showed up and we fought for, you know, what we felt like we deserved.
So, you know, what is Code for America, in case people don't know?
Code for America is a civic tech nonprofit. So we work on a lot of different social programs for America's social safety net. We do work in the criminal justice space, the tax benefits space, and also in the local initiative space. So, you know, we meet with either small city government or community organizations to help make direct impact to the people who are most marginalized in our country and most needed.
And how long was the organizing campaign? How long did it take to get to this moment?
So we started our organizing campaign back in 2021. A small group of folks from our Clear My Record team, which is focused on clearing low-level records of folks that are justice involved. They had a little breakfast and they were like, what would it be like if we organized a union? Maybe we should be part of like this big union movement that is starting to happen right now. And we were recognized back in October of 2021, and we've been bargaining and working hard to get to this first contract ever since.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, Lindley, because, you know, it's one thing to vote to get a union. This is where I was taking James. It's one thing to, you know, to organize. It's one thing to win an election. It's a whole nother thing to get this first contract, this coveted first contract. And I look at what, you know, the Starbucks people, you know, there are hundreds of Starbucks that have organized, you know, their union, but they don't have a contract. It's getting over that hurdle. How difficult was it to get this done?
You know, I think any time that you're working towards your first contract, there's a really big learning curve. And it is a difficult process on both sides because, you know, a lot of us did not grow up being part of a union or experiencing a unionized workplace. You know, I think there was a lot of learning. There was a lot of hard work within our union to understand, like, what does it take to get a first contract? What needs to be in a first contract? Our union did not start necessarily out of a grievance, but more just wanting to protect and secure the culture that we have at our organization, the benefits that we have, which are really, you know, generous. And so moving towards that, it was difficult, certainly, but we're really, really proud of the progress we've made. And out of difficulty definitely comes like collective action, comes community. And we're really proud of the community that we've created here with our union.
No, it's again, incredible stuff. You listen to the Rick Smith Show with Lindley Clausen, program manager and bargaining committee member with OPIU, and James Arms, principal solutions architect and contract action team member. If you want to take a look at their website, CFAWorkersUnited.com is the website where you can find out more of what's going on. So, well, let's talk about this first contract. Since you were on the bargaining committee, Lindley, you know, what'd you get? You know, how did things, because you know, I have this view, union job, better life. The idea of a union contract is to make lives better, to make sure that we put things on papers and they can't be clawed back. How'd we do?
I think we did a great job. There are a lot of things in here that are really new and groundbreaking in our contract. One of the things, a benefit that we secured in our contract is open PTO, flexible PTO. You take time when you need it, you take vacation with you when you need it. There's not a fixed set of number of days that you can take off. We got 3 more weeks of paid parental leave. So now parents can take 17 weeks of parental leave and also can come back part-time after those 17 weeks for an additional 2 months. So we're providing that flexibility for parents. We also got just cause discipline, which is basically due process for the workplace. Most workplaces have at will employment, which means you can be fired anytime. There's a lot more like justification that folks have to make if they want to let someone go, or a lot more monitoring around discipline. And I think we're really excited about some of those big things. Anything you'd add, James?
Yeah, look, you know, I think one of the biggest things we won, and Rick, you really pointed this out, you know, having a union is one thing, having a contract is another. And until you have that contract, you don't really have all of those protections in place. So one of the things that we really fought hard for was layoff protections, making sure that if mass layoffs do hit Code for America, again, we have severance agreements in place. We have a process to bargain for additional severance. We, you know, we made sure that we have months of insurance coverage, because we know that in America, your insurance is covered or tied to your job. So if you lose your job, you lose your health insurance, and we don't want that to happen. So yeah. I really think that's one of the biggest things we've won is those protections. I think additionally, what we came to on compensation, I think is great. I think we came up with a fair compromise where, you know, we have across the board increases over the next 2 years, but we also have the option to reopen negotiations for 2025 if the organization meets certain financial goals.
No,
so if the organization does well, there's a chance for all of us to do even better.
And shouldn't that be the bottom line, that if your work produces, you know, profits, that you share in that? I mean, that seems rational. And I think it's something we talked about as the UAW was on strike. The, you know, the industry was wildly profitable, but they certainly were not sharing the wealth. And this gives you guys the framework to be able to do a bunch of that. And I think that's a good thing.
Absolutely, Rick, 100%.
So let me ask you, James, because, you know, obviously you're part of the action team. You went through the organizing, you went through the election, you got your union, Lindley and company bargained a great contract. Now the hard work begins, the enforcing the contract, keeping people on the same page, and then working for the next one. Are you in the process of planning and working, and what do you see coming forward on that front?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, as Lindley mentioned, this was all a learning process, and this new phase that we're entering in is also going to be a learning process for us. So we are starting our elections for our union stewards. We're doing some sessions with our bargaining unit members next week to make sure they understand what that is, what that responsibility means, and you know, who's going to be good for that. Some of our OPEIU comrades have offered to let us join in on their bargaining unit meeting, who already have a contract, so we can sort of see what it looks like for their stewards to move forward, which is just another, you know, great thing about being in part of a union family is you have all of these comrades that you can reach out and connect to and that can help you work through this, you know, when we're all doing this for the first time.
Lindley, you mentioned a moment ago that you didn't, most people didn't have union experience to draw from. You know, either one of you, did you have a union background, Lindley or James? Is there, you know, uncle in the on the steelworkers, or your brother-in-law, somebody, any experience with unions prior to this?
It's very possible that I've had some family members that have been part of unions, like, you know, grandparents and such. And I believe my mom was part of a teacher's union, but it wasn't necessarily like the forefront of like conversations that we had. So it definitely is something that fell in the background as we've seen like unionization decline. And now we have this resurgence. It was something that I was always like, man, a union's great. But I had no idea that I could be a part of a union and that would be an option for me at a nonprofit, at a tech company. It's really spreading like wildfire, and I'm excited to be a part of it.
No, it's incredible because, you know, we're seeing, like my grandparents' generation, you're seeing unions popping up in places that, you know, over the last couple of generations, you have not seen them. Whereas, you know, you go back to the 1950s, real estate agents and, you know, and waitresses, and you go down the list, everyone had a union that was bargaining for their interests. But James, I wanted to get your thoughts, any background, and then for both of you, you know, what was this experience like? But James, any background?
Yeah, so when I was very, very young, before I could ever remember, my dad, and also before I was ever born, my dad was part of the union. And he was even on the picket lines at Boeing and Westinghouse, but he ultimately left to work for family. And when you work for family, it doesn't usually come with a union.
Yeah, you don't get the picket family. That doesn't go well at Thanksgiving.
Right. But prior to joining CFA, I was actually part of a team at NAVA Public Benefit Corporation, NAVA United. Also part of OPEIU Local 1010. So we worked to organize there. And I actually left that organization to come to Code for America right around the time that they were starting to bargain for their first contract. So it was interesting to not just move organizations, but also move into different phases of organizing at the same time.
Let me ask both of you, because, you know, the hope is that, you know, people listening to this are going to go, hey, maybe we need a union in our workplace. You know, maybe we're coders, maybe we work in an office, or maybe we're, you know, doing any type of job. You know, what advice, Lindley, let's start with you. What advice do you give someone to go through this process?
Yeah, I would say every worker deserves a union. If you're out there thinking my workplace doesn't sound like a place I would unionize, don't think that. You can unionize and be part of, you know, this labor movement. I think it's really incredibly important. I know it's a scary thing sometimes to democratize a workplace, but that's exactly what we need in this country. And even if you have a workplace that is like pretty great, you know, your benefits are dictated by your leadership. It's basically a dictatorship until you unionize and democratize your workplace.
Yep.
So I would say take that first step, have a conversation with some other folks in the union, reach out to us. We're happy to talk to you about it.
Good stuff. James, any thoughts?
Yeah, just do it. Seriously,
with the Nike slogan. You
know, yep. Talk to your closest colleagues at work who have the same frustrations. And I bet you'd be surprised how many of them have thought about this in the past and just don't know where to get started. And to get started, you got to talk to each other and then start talking to people who know what they're doing. You know, depending on your industry, that could be OPEIU, it could be steelworkers, it could be the Teamsters, it could be, you know, communications workers, you know, whatever that is, reach out. There's people, there's resources out there to help you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you hit the nail on the head, Lindley, a minute ago. And one of the things that I say, outside of wages, hours, conditions, which is one of the are the reasons people generally organize, it's that at-will employment thing that I think is so important, that you should only be fired for cause if you screwed something up and you were responsible, not just because the boss got a whim or a bug up his behind. There should be, like anything, due process. So I think you hit that on the head. If you want more information on what Lindley and James have accomplished, CFAWorkersUnited.com. Tons of information there. If you want to contact them and maybe figure out how you can start a union in your workplace, I'm sure they would be more than willing to help, fresh off of this incredible success. James, Lindley, I appreciate you guys taking time for us. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Thank you, Rick.
Great stuff. Again, CFAWorkersUnited.org, the website. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1928. That was the day that police shot at protesting union workers at Prince's Pier in Melbourne, Australia. Three union workers were injured, one fatally. Each day, the workers on the wharf had to muster or gather in hope to be picked for a job by one of the shipping companies. The practice often led to corruption and inconsistent work for the men. The Waterside Workers Federation Union sought an end to the hiring method. The union had been formed in 1901 to represent workers on the waterfront in response to the dangerous and often brutal working conditions workers toiled under. The ship companies were determined to undermine the union's influence. They had the support of Conservative Prime Minister Stanley Bruce. And on this fateful day, armed police brought in non-union workers to Prince's Pier. 1,000 union workers lined the docks to protest against this scab labor. Skirmishes broke out between the police and union workers. The police fired into the crowd. One of those bullets found the neck of Australian World War I veteran Alan Whittaker. Whittaker, like many men, had returned to Australia after the war, seeking work on the docks. It took 3 excruciating months for Whittaker to die from his wound. The shooting was declared justified. In 2010, a group of local historians and union members organized to look further into the case. An article published in the Sydney Morning Herald under the headline, "The Truth Was the First Casualty of the 1928 War on the Waterfront," it concluded the original investigation had been a whitewash. Whittaker's story, like those of workers who died fighting for dignity at the workplace, is up to us to uncover, pass on, and remember. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So get ready for it, because we're going to hear a lot of it over the next couple of days up until the election. Evidently, according to the New York Post, the largest migrant caravan in the year is heading to the U.S. And here's the punchline. The leader is mocking Biden's policies on the border. That's right. You got 7,000 people marching towards the U.S. border, and it's all because Joe Biden has dropped the ball. You know, I see these things, and I got to tell you, I know what kind of organizing goes into to public displays. This really seems well organized. And look, to get 7,000 desperate people to make their way to the U.S. with the promise of, hey, if you can get through the border, if you can get, to Massachusetts, there's a job for you. Because understand, corporate America does amazing work overseas, getting people to think, hey, if we just get here, we can get jobs. And then our lives will get better. Sell them that fool's gold. The border's wide open, they sell. And, I've talked to people who have been down to the border. I'm not quite sure what they mean. It's wide open. There are barriers all over the place. And if you want to walk through the desert or you want to walk through really rough, crazy terrain, I guess you could make it. People do. And there are groups to do that. But this is what happens when you have desperation all around you. And I go back to this weird spot where we're in. Look, I'm someone who says, we have to have border security. Absolutely. But it's kind of, it's crazy that this stuff pops up right around election time. It seems convenient to me that right now at election time, this is what we get. Let's quick go to the phones before we wrap things up. We got Jack in Wisconsin. Jack, what's on your mind?
Well, first of all, talk about serious hypocrisy. The Republicans had full control of both houses and the presidency for two full years, and they did squat about immigration. So, people really have to realize that, and that obviously Biden can only do so much, too. And of course, needs the cooperation of the Republicans to do that. And secondly, this whole thing that the Johnson's pulling in the House, this is just craziness. Again, it's an attempt to trash our economy as quickly as they can, and then say, "Oh, it's Biden's fault." So those are my two thoughts for the evening.
No, I appreciate it, Jack. Thanks so much. You're spot on. And look, Jack's right. The reality is Republicans had control for 2 years. Everything they had full run, and they did nothing on the immigration issue. What they did is they enriched the wealthy. They passed their tax bill. That was their priority. All of this other stuff is convenient to leave undone. And look, you've had a Republican-led House for over a year. What, a year now? A year and a half? What have they done? What have they gotten accomplished? Where's their immigration bill? You would think it would be simple. They've got the votes. They could pass their messaging bill. When you have the power that they have, when you have the majority in the House, that's when you pass your ideological bills. Democrats do it too. They pass a minimum wage increase, knowing that the Senate's not going to move on it. You still do it because it shows your priorities. And Republicans did none of that because they want to use the border issue. They love chaos. They love the fact that there's misery at our border. There's no solutions there. And this is the thing that gets me. And it drives me insane when people go, why hasn't Biden done anything? I think you have to understand that, again, he doesn't have total control of this. This is the fact that Congress repeatedly for decades has fallen down on the job here. There isn't an immigration policy in place. Yes, there is. It's illegal to be here. People have the right to seek asylum. Unless you're willing to undo that, which they claim they are. I haven't seen the bill. I haven't seen the legislation. They haven't passed anything. So when they talk, it's all just lies and BS. Show me what you want by what you do. It's kind of like all the election stuff. They're going around, the election was stolen. And show me what they said in court. Tell me where all of this election fraud happened. in a court filing. Show me where Rudy Giuliani went in with all of those fantastical claims of you know, people, you know, stuffing ballots and moving hard drives and you know, sticking flash drives, who knows where. Show me where that happened in a court of law, and then we'll discuss it. But standing in the parking lot of the Four Seasons Landscaping Company making wild claims, I don't need that nonsense. I don't need a snake oil salesman with, you know, whatever that was dripping down his face. I don't need that headache. It's the same thing with this immigration policy. It's convenient that right now, days before an election, this just pops up. It's amazing how that happens. It's amazing how it always seems to happen right around the same time. Just like it's amazing when gas prices go up right around election time. It's amazing how, you know, they work towards, well, let's have recession right before a major election. It's quite remarkable. It's almost like they plan it.
This you're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
Fast to preserve hometown.